all across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlow.
Good morning. Welcome back to Up North News Radio in Abashedly, Wisconsin, brought to you by Courier Newsroom, carried by our friends on the Civic Media Radio Network, live from Chippewa Falls. I'm Pat Kreitlow. It's 7:06. It's nice to have you here on this Tuesday morning, July 16th. Coming up this hour, Civic Media News Director Terry Bell is standing by and will talk to us about day one of the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee and what to expect here on day two. In about 15 minutes or less, we'll be talking to former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel about the decision by a Trump-appointed judge in Florida to entirely throw out the case against former President Donald Trump for improperly taking, improperly storing, possibly disseminating, and refusing to return a trove of documents with national security information on them. So that's at 7:20. 7:34, we'll talk to Rick Wilson from the Lincoln Project, a group of Republicans who would like to try to take their party back from the extremism of the Trump movement. And then Chad Holmes joins us at about 7:50. So a busy hour ahead, starting with the weather. But before we get to Brittany Merlot, we ask that, again, to honor the singer from the All-Star Game, you please rise for about 10 seconds of the national anthem performed not so goodly. Anyway, moving on.
I know. I wouldn't be able to do that. I know that that's got to be just. But like I said, look, to you, Pat, less cursive on the singing. Just less cursive.
Yeah. Look, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson spoke at the convention yesterday. His teleprompter gave out. He had the good sense to just walk away. And sometimes you think in a rendition of a song, I got to think there's been people in the middle of a song on karaoke have said, oh, wait, I'm too sober for this. I should go now. Which brings us to Brittany Merlot and a gorgeous morning up here on Lake Wissota. I know it was definitely not a gorgeous evening for parts south of here. It was very stormy. Let's hear more about that and the forecast for the rest of this Tuesday. Brittany, good morning.
Oh, good morning. I will say we definitely had a 715 day yesterday because we avoided the worst of it. We were dry. While down south, they were getting smacked with 84-mile-per-hour wind gusts were clocked into Rock County, 78-mile-per-hour winds into Greene, 72-mile-per-hour winds at Grant, and that just continued. There was even funnel clouds being reported into Evansville, where there was 3 feet of water over Highway 23 and Highway A as well. So it was just a mess down there. I even heard of reports of ping pong ball size hail, too. I think that was in Greene County. So that is massive, but it got even worse as the system pushed and bowed into Illinois. There were 1.10 tornado warnings at one time, all headed into the suburbs, moving into the city, very populated areas. But of course, Kenosha, too, getting pounded with rainfall. I think it was over 2.5 inches of rain all at once, flooding there as well. And you had hit 90 degrees earlier in the day. So wild, wild weather. That cold front moved in. Now we're going to start to see some calmness, some dry conditions, and actually so staying below average for temperatures. In fact, highs both tomorrow and even Thursday are going to be only into the mid-70s. So a little relief headed our way all week long. Although today, a few pop-up scattered showers are possible later tonight. They'll be widely scattered. It'll just be mostly sunny. Low 80s.
Very nice. All right, Brittany, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Have a wonderful day.
You too.
All right, let's jump right into Civic Media News Director Terry Bell joining us from Milwaukee, where the Republican National Convention heads into its second day. Terry, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Pat. I'm pretty good. I'm pretty good tired, but good.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I did see the photo that you took from your perch at the Fiserv Forum. It was relatively, shall we say, nosebleedy, but it did give you, you know, a view of the scene, and you could listen into the proceedings. Had you been to a national convention before? Do you have anything to compare it to?
I really have nothing to compare it to. Maybe some major sporting events in terms of the sheer number of people. But, you know, it is a strange scene. The streets of downtown Milwaukee, you know, fenced, very high fences, barricades, traffic problems, serious traffic problems. That the first day was a huge learning curve for a lot of commuters and, you know, people going to and from the convention as well. To get into a parking spot at the convention, the designated ones, the ones that we were cleared for, every single car took about a 5-minute security sweep. So imagine if you're in line with several cars, you know, what that must be like. But you know, it just goes to show, yeah, this is like nothing else, and especially since Saturday. But nothing changed. Things went on very much as planned. No adjustments were made to security or the schedule or anything like that. You know, there was a sense of, you know, a concern in the air in the morning, but by midday, I think everyone let their guard down a little bit, and the day went on as planned.
Do you think that wasn't in part because the planned protest march, folks gathered at Red Arrow Park, and then they marched, you know, to the perimeter, the security perimeter, but there were no incidents, and the last report I'd seen from Milwaukee police, which was late afternoon, but that there were no arrests either, and that at this point, everybody has been, shall we say, behaving themselves, and so despite the security concerns, and obviously security concerns are very real, but, you know, it appears that that first day has set what folks hope will be the tone for the whole convention.
At this point, anyway, is of a mind to provoke anyone. Some Trump supporters and protesters had words as the parade went by, but that was it. As you mentioned, there were no arrests and no incidents.
Yeah, and you know, again, there's no guarantees on how things go for, you know, this part moving forward. But good things to report from day one. As you know, talk to people, you know, walking through the area, delegates especially, of course, would you say that the tone among them was upbeat, that they were happy to be there at the convention, or that they were much more serious and focused on, you know, the campaign against President Biden? What kinds of impressions did you get?
I would say it was an upbeat atmosphere. It even kind of takes on the feeling of a street festival a bit, with food stands and live music happening all over the campus there, between the Baird Center and Fiserv Forum, with Panther Arena in the middle. You know, if you hadn't picked up a newspaper or listened to a radio station in the last week, you would have never had any idea that there was perhaps a serious international incident that happened on Saturday.
Okay, well, that's good. Did you end up staying late enough through the evening session? I'm wondering if you, because again, you probably had a long walk back to your car and things. I was seeing some pictures in the early evening that showed that downtown businesses were practically empty, that they weren't seeing the customers that they thought they would see, but I'm sure a lot of them were in the evening session as well, and I'm wondering if you happened to notice any ancillary activity. And again, we have nothing to compare it to, but you know, what it looked like to you as that first day wrapped up.
Mike Holmgren, the former coach of the Green Bay Packers, used to like to say that being on the sidelines, the game is the worst. They're the worst seats in the house. You're really close, but you can't see anything. And that's kind of the same here at the convention. You know, even though you're right in the heart of things, you're so restricted in where you can go that it's hard to get a sense of what's happening. The bigger picture, you don't get the proverbial 30,000 foot view. So yeah. I don't doubt that there were some empty places or some slow places. I remember in the morning, covering the Wisconsin delegation breakfast. The delegates were instructed, don't stray too far from campus for very long because we got a schedule to keep, and you need to be here at this place at this time and at that place at that time. And so I think people were, I think that was the mindset. That would be my
sure.
guess.
It, yeah, keeps you from visiting elsewhere and spending the money and putting it around there. So I wanted to ask about any reaction to the J.D. Vance selection as Trump's running mate. Did you talk to anybody who had much to say, good or bad, about that?
Spoke to people who were not very surprised. They figured it was a fit for Donald Trump. I was a bit surprised because normally a running mate is someone who's supposed to broaden your appeal a little bit. And yeah. it would seem that J.D. Vance, I don't know how many undecided voters he'll flip. So we'll see. I'm a little skeptical. I would have thought a Nikki Haley or a Nikki Haley type might have been mm-hmm. his best chance. But, you know, I'm not a political pundit in Washington. So what do I know?
Yeah. Well, Nikki Haley will be speaking today to the convention. Senator Ron Johnson spoke yesterday, and his staff says the wrong speech was loaded into the prompter, and that's why last night's speech had so much more red meat rather than a theme of unity. Take that with whatever size grain of salt you want. Was it your impression that Senator Johnson and any other Wisconsin folks were well-received?
People were very well received in Wisconsin. You're right. The Ron Johnson speech, at least in Wisconsin, ended up being the big takeaway of the day. Certainly not something that I'm sure the organizers of the convention would have wanted a gaffe to be the story. You're right. Perhaps it was not a gaffe. Perhaps somebody with ulterior motives changed the script. But he gave the speech, and afterwards he says he stood by what he said. But, you know, I, as someone who's done some public speaking, it would have taken me a second to adjust
I'm certainly wondering if there was actually ever a second speech written or just a convenient excuse offered. Civic Media News Director Terry Bell will have more throughout the day and into the evening from the Republican National Convention in downtown Milwaukee. Terry, thanks so much. Take care. Have a great day.
Thank you, Pat.
On the way, on the other side of this break, I should say, we're going to hear from U.S. Attorney, former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel, about the dismissal of the Mar-a-Lago documents case against former President Trump. This is Up North News Radio for a Tuesday morning. Back in just a bit.
We're going hopping, hop, we're going hopping today, when things are popping, hop, the Philadelphia way, we're going to drop it, drop, on all the music they play, on the bandstand.
Coming up on August 13th, learn more about it, how to get registered, where to vote, and so forth at myvote.wi.gov. I spoke late yesterday to former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel about a Florida judge dismissing the documents case against former President Trump. She claimed that the special counsel was appointed in an unconstitutional manner. That's not what other courts have said time and time and time again. So I began talking to Jim Santel by asking him, what's the difference here?
This is, to call it an outlier, Pat, is to be charitable. This is inconsistent not only with what the Supreme Court of the United States has said before about the legitimacy of this special counsel process, but all sorts of other courts, including, you're making reference, for example, to the others in history, the Bob Mueller investigation. That's a special counsel. Special counsel right now investigating and pursuing the prosecutions of the president's son, Hunter Biden. That's a special counsel. His name is David Weiss. We've got others, of course, in our history, including Robert here as well, who investigated Joe Biden. All of these are special counsel. And the significant response to your question is, every court that has decided this up until now, including district court judges, the District of Columbia, appeals court judges, the Supreme Court, each one of them has looked at this process, which does in fact raise issues about appropriations and appointments, as Aline Cannon identifies him as well, and says, no problem here, nothing unconstitutional. This has been visited and revisited and revisited, and nobody, including Trump-appointed district court judges in the District of Columbia, have found that this is problematic this is truly, truly, again, beyond being an outlier, this is the kind of case that just finds no support in precedent. And I dare say to say that she's making this up, but she's plucking up an issue that's been resolved for the purpose of getting rid of this case, very dispositively, but getting rid of it nonetheless.
Well, I mean, precedent being the key word here, because Roe v. Wade was precedent, and we kept hearing that until the opportunity arose to overturn it. And now with a Trump-appointed judge who's clearly got an ideological bent to her on the case, suddenly there's the opportunity that you see to say, what precedent? Precedent doesn't matter. And yet when the case was assigned to her, randomly we're told, I mean, a whole lot of us said, uh-oh. And yet I don't know that anything could have been done, but if so, it wasn't. We just let her have it and let her sit on it for months.
Right. And she has done just that. Again, this is the capping piece of all that she has done here. But she has had hearings and she's entertained all kinds of again, forgive me for calling them, but they're everybody on all sides of the political aisle describes some of these motions as being frivolous, as being not just borderline, but being dismissible easily. She entertains all of this as a way of, again, extending the time periods on this case, sending some very peculiar signals about jury instructions. And now in the wake of all of that, including recent hearings, by the way, in which she has entertained things even of more substance, now she produces this 93-page order that plainly has been in the mix, in the works, for weeks, if not months, and says, oh, by the way, from the very start, this prosecution was doomed. This is the kind of, it's a threshold issue that other judges should have taken, would have taken up early and gotten disposed of dispositively and say, no, there's nothing there. She should have done this early on. And then we'd be at the appellate level right now if, in fact, that's where Jack Smith wants to go.
Can I just say that one of the things that really bothers me about this is not that the Department of Justice or the Attorney General, gave this to a special counsel instead of, DOJ prosecutors handling it themselves, although that's certainly part of it. But these are classified documents. This is sensitive information relative to national security. And yet I just don't get that sense of urgency that would seem to accompany something like this. And I just don't know what I'm missing here. I don't think you can be accused of overplaying or overhyping such reckless handling of such top secret information.
You cannot make that accusation and make it stick. And sometimes we forget your important point there, Pat. We talk about, the hearings, and we talk about the judges, and we talk about the 11th Circuit, other things going on here. We forget what the underlying accounts are all about. And you're right, it goes to our national security. We do not know to this day, and probably will not know for generations until some of these documents are disclosed publicly to our great-grandchildren, what impact some of this may have had upon our national security and upon our people overseas who may have been compromised by virtue of some of these releases. We don't know. This is an horrific national security breach. That's why it was brought. It's not just, it's easy also to talk about as a documents case. I know we had some boxes in the bathroom and on the stage there in Mar-a-Lago, and we all sort of smile knowingly about that. It is much more important than that. And that's the reason why Jack Smith brought this case. That's the reason why he's vindicating an interest of the American population in ensuring not only in the integrity of this process, but also our national security itself. Your point cannot be overstated.
All right, so let's game this out. What are the possibilities moving forward from here? How many different possibilities, and of them, what do you think is likely to happen?
Sure. So one of them is that Jack Smith does nothing. Part of me says Jack Smith's got to be scratching his head after the immunity decision and then this, and saying, gee, why don't I go back to The Hague and prosecute war crimes where I get justice and I get some sense of moving forward? Unlikely that will happen here. But again, a prosecutor can simply walk away from a case. That's one. Unlikely that will happen. The one that everyone's talking about is appealing this. It is a final dispositive order. There's nothing left in this case. She has made that clear. You can go to the 11th Circuit. You can file the notice of appeal. That process, not only the period of time during which Jack Smith can notice that appeal, but the oral arguments, the motions, the the memorandums, the briefs that will be filed before the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. That will take months. That takes us well into the next calendar year. We saw the 11th Circuit before shut down this judge when she was involved in that civil case that tried to bring this to an end, and they smacked her down on that. But regardless of what the 11th Circuit does here, that is a decision that's going to be heard probably maybe earliest next time this year, could even be in the following year. That's the second option. The third one that I would offer here as well, as somebody who's worked inside the Department of Justice, and that is you choose not to appeal this, but now that the case is done, it's not been dismissed with prejudice, so to speak, which means that the allegations underneath the indictment itself can be pursued. Assign it, as you just implicitly indicated, Pat, assign it back to where maybe it should have been in the start. Let's not go down this special counsel road before. I've been critical, frankly, of this attorney general for being a little bit too special counsel happy when it comes to these appointments. This is what the Department of Justice, the criminal division, the public integrity section, this is what they're assigned to do for decades. They've got expertise. They know how to do this. They're right now working with Jack Smith on this. But if the problem is his appointment, take it out of there. Get it back in the hands of people who are responsible directly to the attorney general. Represent these cases, these allegations, to a federal grand jury, 26 people there in the District of Columbia, and see if grand jury finds that there is probable cause, as the other grand jury did, to reindict.
Jim, I cannot thank you enough for getting us up to speed on this very troubling development, but thank you for it, and we'll talk to you again Friday.
Thanks so much. Good to talk with you, as always.
So, I mean, you can hear in his voice as a former U.S. attorney saying, you didn't really need a special counsel in the first place. This is what a Department of Justice is built to do. The Attorney General, Merrick Garland, was overly cautious, saying, well, we don't want it to be accused of being President Biden's Justice Department. Well, if a Justice Department is independent, you're built to bring these cases. And that's his point, that bring the case, bring it somewhere else, not to a Trump-appointed judge. Pam Yonke has the Midwest Farm Report next. Rick Wilson from the Lincoln Project also coming up from the Republican Convention on Up North News Radio.
Because I'm on the American bandstand. When we dance real slow.
I know you're lying, cause your lips are moving. Tell me, do you think I'm dumb? I might be young, but I ain't stupid. Talking round in circles with your tongue. I gave you bass, you gave me sweet talk.
We are awaiting an update on the Republican National Convention from Rick Wilson from the Lincoln Project. The Lincoln Project, a group of primarily Republicans who would like their party back, have a party back that puts country before party and does not forget the notion of national service and does not do its work from a position primarily of grievances. So if and when Rick joins us, we'll talk a bit more about the convention. We'll certainly be talking to him and others over the coming days about the selection of J.D. Vance, the Ohio senator, as a running mate for President Trump. And as you heard from Terry Bell a little bit earlier this hour, it's not that J.D. Vance brings anything new to the ticket. He instead just reinforces the white guy grievances that Donald Trump is known for. We've said before, Donald Trump isn't expanding his base at all. He is instead looking to solidify the base and get more of them to show up on election day. And that's certainly something that's in the Trump playbook. Anyway, Hans Breitenmoser often joins us on Tuesdays as well and is nice enough to pinch hit here and talk to us a bit about the Republican convention from the standpoint of what it means to rural America, to farmers and more. Hans, good morning. How are things on the farm up by Merrill?
Good morning, Pat. Things aren't just too bad up here in Merrill.
No? Okay. I mean,
it's not raining right now.
It's not raining. See? Little things. We'll take that. As J.D. Vance comes from, you know, the coal mining areas, you know, Kentucky, West Virginia, maybe a part of southwestern Pennsylvania, and in that way thinks he's bringing some kind of a connection to rural America. But I just wonder your own impressions on what this Republican convention is messaging to rural voters, especially farmers, at this point.
Well, I don't know. I mean, to me, it seems a little bit of the same old from the quote conservatives, kind of pandering to rural America a little bit, but keeping us, keeping, and when I say us, I mean, you know, our country, just held back. I mean, we need to move forward from some of these things. And you mentioned, coal country. I mean, you know, I there's very few people who, you know, don't understand at this point that we need to move on from fossil fuels, that rural America can have a booming economy with by using, you know, renewable energy, because we have wind and sun out here. We've got biodigesters and on farms and so forth. So we need to be moving the needle in the progressive direction when it comes to the economy and to the environment out in the countryside. And this is just another step backward, in my estimation.
Yeah, because it appears already that through the Inflation Reduction Act and, you know, and other measures that the Biden administration has taken, we're already seeing that job growth in rural America. And that is very much threatened if the Inflation Reduction Act were to be struck down, is this boomlet that's already starting across rural America.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's like you said, it's just starting. We're on the front end of this thing. This the Inflation Reduction Act and all that goes with it has really big, really long-term implications for rural America, has implications for all of America, implications for rural America is where I come from. So this is just a step backward, and I hope voters really understand that there's an opportunity here to choose a leader and a party that that, you know, can move us, keep moving us forward, or we can just keep going back to the Stone Ages.
I couldn't agree more. Hans, stick around, stand by here. Rick Wilson's joining us now from the Lincoln Project. Rick, good morning. Thank you for being here this morning. Yeah. Hey, we're talking to Hans Breitenmoser. He's a dairy farmer from up north in Lincoln County, northern Wisconsin. Are you there, Rick? Oh, he's kind of frozen. We'll see if Rick joins us again. And Hans, you're still there. You're still hearing me, right?
I'm hearing you.
Okay. Okay. We'll see if Rick comes back on here. So we were getting into the jobs that are coming from new energies and the benefit there, not to mention the infrastructure investments. And we don't have to dwell a lot on that, but It's going to be really hard for a Trump-Vance ticket to talk about how they could do more for infrastructure than the bipartisan infrastructure law has already done.
Well, I think so. And again, you got to look at the sort of the philosophical bent here, right? I mean, when you've got one party and one platform that sort of understands that public-private partnerships are good things and that public policy matters, and the other one is, you know, more concerned about, you know, the enrichment of the 1%, then what kind of policy are you going to get that is actually going to have an impact, a positive impact on people's lives locally? I mean, when we talk about the IRA, we're talking about insulating people's houses and more solar panels, more energy efficient things. These are all job creators right down close to the ground level. And that small businesses, laborers, that labor unions are going to benefit from. Compared to the alternative, which is cricket, nothing, right? It's the same old infrastructure enriching the same people that have been enriched by this system for years. So it's time to move forward, and that means we have to have a platform that will move us forward. And the good news is that we don't need to invent that. The IRA has already put so much time and energy behind that, more than any other thing has in decades. Why do you want to stop and switch gears and reverse now? It makes no sense to me.
There you go. Okay, hopefully we've got we had little technical glitches with both Greg and with Rick Wilson, and both appear to be back now. Rick, good morning. I'll throw the question back at you again, just from more of a rural America standpoint. What is it? Well, first off, overall, what is it that Trump has to offer rural America, and does adding J.D. Vance to the ticket add any value to that particular demographic?
I mean, look, I think J.D. Vance helps Trump in the Fox green room audience more than anything else, because although he played this sort of character that he wrote in Hillbilly Elegy, it turns out it was mostly sort of contrived. It was kind of an exaggeration, to put it mildly, of his life story. But I'll say this, and I think the point that Greg was making, we have an emerging potential in rural America for the Inflation Reduction Act, even the CHIPS and Science Act, and the infrastructure bill to transform a lot of the weak spots in rural America. And what do you see from Donald Trump and Project 2025? You see a very negative vision of the future. They're not going to do anything about the industrialization of agriculture. They're not going to do anything about protecting water supplies, watersheds, things like that. They're going to unwind a lot of the things that American rural in ag and timber and other areas need to survive. And, you know, and this may be relatively controversial. My family is in agriculture in Florida. And right now, the crackdowns on legal and and illegals that they're promising will devastate the citrus and cattle and industry in Florida. So we're seeing a lot of potential downsides from the Trump and the Project 2025 plan, and a lot of upsides from where Joe Biden has gone in the last 3 years in this country.
You know, one of the things that when Hans joins us every couple of weeks or so as a dairy farmer and as somebody active in the Farmers Union, one of the things that we often bring up is getting more of a farm audience and a rural audience to understand the squeeze they're getting, especially from monopoly growth in corporate America. And the ability to be pro-business and pro-small business and yet not favor, you know, monopolies. And I don't, again, I'm not hearing from Trump and the Trump wing of the party any acknowledgement that there needs to be from time to time a reining in of corporate power, because otherwise you're squeezing farmers and you're also squeezing the consumers. And I'm wondering if you see anything in an economic platform, or is it just the same old populist language? Maybe a little angrier version of the same old populist language.
Well, one thing I certainly see is that if he decides to impose 100% tariffs across the board on every imported product, American farm exports are going to crash to the floor. It's over. We're not going to be exporting the things right now that in ag specifically, but also in timber and other market sectors. You're not going to be able to have a global presence anymore. You're not going to be able to sell to markets, you know, well before. And to your point about industrialization and monopolization, this is a thing that is eating up industries across the country, and in agriculture specifically. I mean, we've got a lot of farmers now who are basically tenants and basically working for the company store when it comes to these mega corporations that are taking over more and more and more and more. You know, when you're down to basically two hog processors in the country, when you're down to basically four cotton companies in the country, these things are all contracting and contracting because, you know, corporate power hates entrepreneurship. They don't want that. They want to control the market as much as they can. And I say that as a free market conservative. I don't believe in, you know, I'm not a state guy. I'm saying this because we are seeing these big companies that are hurting small and medium-sized farms across the country in every single ag sector. I mean, We're in citrus, soybeans, hogs, and cotton, and it is the squeeze is terrifying. And you know, I'm not in the business myself, but my cousin's going to be the last one in it, because you know, it's just gotten to be economically really, really tough to do this work. And I'm sure Hans knows that story very well. It's a hard life. It's a tough business, and when you're under pressure from people who are driving your prices down or making it harder and harder and harder for you to maintain your land, your crops, your cattle, it's a really ugly world sometimes. And I don't think you're going to see that from a guy who was raised in a tower in the middle of Manhattan, and who's never worked a day in his life, who does not know, you know, a PTO from a golf driver. This is not a guy who understands things outside of Manhattan or elite golf courses.
No.
He's not the populist people think he is.
No. I've got 2 minutes before a break that I've got to hit, and then Rick, I'm going to ask if you can hang around for a couple of extra minutes here. But Hans, let me start this question to you first, and that is, we've talked about all the economics, the investments into rural America, and yet we know that the message that often sticks in rural America is one that is based much more in other, shall we say, social issues, grievances, and other things. You know the challenge up there of communicating much more of an economic slash practical message. How do you feel that's going in places like northern Wisconsin? Or is all this conversation, you know, does it make us feel good, but it the needle is not going to move this November up north?
Well, I don't know, Pat. That's a good question. I'm a simple dairy farmer. I'm not a political pundit, so it's hard for me to understand what motivates people. I mean, we've seen historically in this country, people are often willing to vote against their own self-interest because the messenger has convinced them that they're right and the rest of the world is wrong. But I think it's just somehow or another, media outlets and folks who are running for more local offices need to keep that message alive about look at the history, look at the policies that have been supported. And like Rick suggested too, I mean, we in rural America here, we're not flaming socialists. We're very much capitalist, right. But we believe in capitalism at the small level. And when you've got public policy that does not enforce antitrust legislation, you know, that's really all we're looking for. We're looking to make sure that corporate America, Wall Street, doesn't eat us alive or slowly fry us like a frog and we don't even know it's happening. We need to move that needle.
Unless, of course, you're going to come take our guns away or whatever messages exactly. Tend to work there. Hans, thank you so much for popping in with us. Appreciate it. Have a great day. We'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Rick Wilson continues with us from the Lincoln Project. Chad Holmes as well. Next, you're up north. That's the theme from one Chad Holmes, whose radio show follows next on Bull Falls Radio here on the Civic Media Network. And he joins me along with Rick Wilson from the Lincoln Project. Mr. Holmes, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great, but if I leave, it's because my teleprompter's out. So just be aware.
Here's the thing, Chad. I won one election in 2006, and then I lost in 2010, and I lost for Congress in 2012. And in the two elections I lost, the thing that both Sean Duffy and my legislative opponent hit me with was, oh, well, he's just a teleprompter reader. And so every time I see, you know, people rip on teleprompters and then have the inability to use one, it just warms my heart. It just makes me feel good that you can't just speak from the heart. You know?
Well, it's been for decades now. I mean, that's all Barack Obama ever did. Remember?
Oh yeah, you just read a teleprompter, right?
And the thing is, I mean, it's part of the for better or worse. I mean, you go back, 40 years. I mean, President Reagan was great with it as well. I mean, it's part of the gig. But I just found it incredibly ironic that yesterday not mm-hmm. only our Johnson & Johnson boys were having some issues with
yes.
teleprompters.
Ron and Mike were having trouble with it.
And by the way, how much of a clown does, and again, I guess maybe I shouldn't use such terminology, but is Ron Johnson that J.D. Vance is considered a good vice presidential nominee, and Ron Johnson was never even in the conversation.
We have asked that conversation, so it's perfect for Rick here. Rick, Wisconsin's a swing state. You'd think sure. Ron Johnson would be on any short list. He was on nobody's short list. What does that say about this process or the party in this day and age?
I think he's sort of the like cheese curd Ted Cruz. He's deeply unfriendly. Nobody likes the guy.
Yeah.
He's just not, he is an unlikable person. And I think that's part of this is that, Trump is looking for somebody who can go on TV and and be an effective communicator. That ain't Ron Johnson.
No, you're, and we get all that. It seems odd that he wasn't, that Wisconsin just wasn't even considered that way for its senator. But it does take me to the main thing I wanted to ask you about, and that is the convention itself. Yeah, J.D. Vance is going to try to look like some kind of a moderate, but, you know, and the thing with the Ron Johnson speech was, oh, we were supposed to have something more unified in there. And I've been asking for a couple of weeks here, Are the Republicans putting on this convention really trying to put on a kinder, gentler facade, or will instead this convention, by the time it's all done, will they simply take whatever's left of the moderate, you know, veneer, the mask off and say, look, this is who we are? Is that where this convention's inevitably going to go, Rick? Or will they really go with, oh, no, we're moderates. Trust us.
Look, they when it comes to the MAGA party of today, it's not like my old Republican party I grew up in. The old Republican party always kept the crazy in the corner, always kept the crazy behind the door. Now, it was always there. There was always some crazy there. But now the crazy always wants to get out. Now the crazy always wants to go, you know, as far forward as it can. And they won't be able to help themselves in the end. Like last night, you saw David Sacks go out there and give a pro-Putin, anti-Ukraine speech, and he got booed on the floor. The crazy, though, is always there. They're going to be fighting tooth and nail to control people talking about their plans for the future, Project 2025, Agenda 47, all these other things. They're going to be fighting every minute of this camp of this convention to try to restrain the outliers, the lunatics, the screamers. But, you know, when you've got a convention where Carrie Lake is speaking and Marjorie Taylor Greene is speaking, you're going to end up getting the crazy thrown into the bucket. They can't stop themselves.
And look, Rick and everybody else at Project 2025, Trigvi Olsen, we'll be talking to Joe Trippi tomorrow. Everybody associated with this movement is referencing back to Project 2025 because, as I like to put it, they were crazy enough to put it all in writing. Chad, with Rick and the Lincoln Project working on that, from your show's standpoint and the calls you take, do you feel like that is starting to set in with some folks that they're that Project 2025 isn't just some concept, but that there actually is a plan in writing that might not be very good for northern Wisconsin? Or is there still a lot of work to do up there?
I think you can say both. I think that it's better than it was a month or 2 months ago, where I think nobody was keeping it on their radar. But I do think that leaders within the Democratic Party and the campaigns are getting much better at it. And obviously, I would hope that in the run-up to the Democratic Convention next month and at the Democratic Convention, that's a big part of it. Absolutely. And by the way, real quickly as well, in terms of, you know, I think we followed politics and conventions and tickets for many years. I don't see where J.D. Vance really, of all the candidates, looking at it from my perspective, that said, boy, this person could add this or this person could add that. J.D. Vance doesn't really add much of anything. It's a state that's been very much in the Republican slot for many cycles now for the past two decades. For the weaknesses Tim Scott has, it's certainly a different constituency.
No, but there is a method to the madness. And I'll say again that Donald Trump was never going to attract new folks. He has to make sure that the base shows up, and he needs to do to get more people to show up who've never voted before but are saying, hey, I like this. He's my guy. And this is where Rick comes back into the picture because, look, it doesn't matter if – I won't say it doesn't matter if Biden's on the ticket or not, but if the message is what the Republican Party has become and Trumpism, Rick, you've got a message that you have to give to some of those same voters sure. to say, hey, you know, this guy ain't worth it.
You know, look, I think Donald Trump picked J.D. Vance in part because a lot of Donald Trump's supporters, a lot of his billionaire friends, Elon Musk, et cetera, really like J.D. Vance. They see him as the future of a nationalist, populist, isolationist movement. And it's hard to sell that in America. Americans still believe that we have a special role in the world and at home. They still believe in a more optimistic vision. Both Trump and Vance have this very pessimistic vision of what America is and can be. And I think that is the biggest weakness of making this pick on the ticket. I really don't think, and again, as you know, correctly, he's not going to, you didn't need to have J.D. Vance on the ticket to get Ohio. It's a red state. It's a really red state. So he doesn't bring you anything in the traditional political metrics, but he does, you know, have that continuation of the nationalist populist Steve Bannon wing of the Republican Party movement that is not traditionally imbued with that optimism about America. And no. So I think he's a dark kind of candidate.
And will undermine elections to get there if need be. Rick Wilson, this was a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. Chad Holmes is coming up next on Bull Falls Radio. Chad, thank you as well. You guys both have a great day. There will be continued coverage of the Republican National Convention from Milwaukee coming up throughout the day. Todd Alba's show at noon. Terry Bell will have coverage this evening as well. Just a reminder that Up North News is the Wisconsin outlet for Courier, a pro-democracy news network building a more informed, engaged, and representative America. Get our newsletter at upnorthnewswi.com. Thanks for being here today. Have a wonderful Tuesday. We'll see you tomorrow here up north.